Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You are listening to Mist Apex Tech Time with Summer's F1. We live F1. I'm your host, Matt Trumpets, and once again, we're fortunate enough to be joined by the hardest working man in tech F1, Matthew Summerfield, a.k.a. Summer's F1 Assistant Technical Editor at Motorsport.com, who has deigned to sit down and share some wisdom with us. It's good to see you again. Thanks for taking the time.
No problem, Matt. It's great to be along again.
Yes, well, and so much has happened in tech world since I saw you last, but it's been tough with these back-to-back races to create some time to talk about the more exciting, interesting, and important technical stuff.
Yeah, there's certainly been a challenging schedule this season.
It has, and it may not be any better next season, as we all know. But I figure, even though I kind of want to get to the Mercedes power unit, let's talk about the DRS stuff first, because that's a big technical issue that happened, and a lot of people were very, very interested in it. And maybe just help understand the difference between technical infringements and sporting infringements, because there is a big difference in how they are looked at. So let's just start with the obvious stuff. What went wrong, and why did it go wrong?
Okay, so Mercedes essentially got dinged for their DRS slot gap. Now, basically, the technical regulations permit you to have a 10mm slot gap when the wing is in a closed position and an 85mm gap when the wing is open. Unfortunately for Mercedes, their wing, when it was open, was above the 85mm threshold. Very, very slightly, I might add, 0.2mm, in fact. So that is the reason why they were dinged by the FIA. And it must be said that this was done after qualifying. That's a very important part that we must talk about perhaps a little bit later when we reference how Red Bull have, you know, been fixing their wings over the last few races as well. Because there's certain criteria, obviously, that the teams have to follow throughout the course of a race weekend. As I say, Mercedes had this issue after qualifying when they were in scrutineering.
Okay, so they had this issue. It's 0.2 of a millimeter, which honestly, having seen the test, which is just basically, I think it was just a disc, right? They just shove it in between the thing. I'm amazed they could discover that it was, or discern that it was just 0.2 millimeter. But what kind of benefit would that have brought them?
The difference for me is that it might actually be a disadvantage. There's nothing to say that it causes an advantage because the 0.2 millimeter is a measurement that's only over on one side of the wing. In the central portion and on the other side of the wing, it actually met the tolerance. However, when you get to the side that failed, it did obviously measure 0.2 millimeters. Now, the other thing to bear in mind, obviously, you mentioned the fact that there's a disc that's used when they're doing this test. It's also covered by a technical directive whereby there's a force applied to that section of 10 newtons. So it does also have to cater for that as part of the test.
Well, that's interesting. One of our tech patrons actually would like to know about that technical directive. When did it come about? How long has it been in force? And why did they decide to add a force to what was formerly a static measurement?
Okay, so a few questions, the answers to which are the technical directive came in 2019, as did the regulations, because as you remember, we had some regulation changes back in 2019. We had a more simplified rear wing. We had the front wings change with a lot of the furniture taken away from them. And the technical directive was brought in as part of this force measurement. In order to understand when it came in, if you take a look at the numbers of the technical directive, that will give you the clues to which you are looking for. The dash 19 on the end refers to the year. So it was introduced in 2019. And then obviously the numbers at the start of the technical directive tell you at which point in the year it was added. So I think was it 011-19, that particular technical directive. So it was the 11th technical directive of the year, which means it was probably pretty early in the season, if not actually ahead of the season, that technical directive came into force. Obviously, that just added the force component to the test to improve the stringency, because we were moving to a new set of regulations. The FIA were just feeling their way into them and perhaps needed this additional force to be able to get a good guide on what was actually happening with the DRS slot.
Okay. So let's ask this question then. What is the FIA with this regulation trying to prevent the teams from doing? How do they feel like the teams might be unfairly using this extra space to get an unfair advantage?
So the unfair advantage that you would get if you were over the tolerance by a significant amount and it was obviously linear across the wing would be that you would get a more powerful DRS. Now, in 2019, the DRS was improved in terms of its ferocity anyway, because we went from a 65 millimeter slot gap, if I remember correctly, under the old regulations to this new 85 millimeter dimension. So DRS actually was made a little bit more powerful in that instance. So that's what they were trying to do, is basically just measure the difference between the slot gap in order to make sure that the team were legal. Which unfortunately they fell foul of this time around.
Okay. And now you said that it was a 0.2 millimeter gap and that it might have been a disadvantage. So why then was there a penalty if it might not have even helped Mercedes?
As I say, the timing of the particular failing of this test is crucial in the situation that unfolded, because they failed a technical regulation, which, as we know from a few races back in Hungary, when I went to say Racing Point then, I meant Aston Martin, they failed a technical regulation when there couldn't be enough fuel drawn out of the car. So if you fail a technical regulation, technically the car isn't, within the scope of the rules. And that is the reason why you end up with a failure. As I mentioned earlier on, we have this situation that seems to have unfolded over the last few races where Red Bull have been repairing their rear wing. And that's been brought up by Mercedes because they're unhappy that they feel that they should have been given the opportunity to repair the wing under part firme conditions, as Red Bull have been doing as well. However, the difference again is timing. Red Bull have been doing this prior to qualifying, so they found the problem between free practice and qualifying and made the repairs so that when they do get to scrutineering, they don't fall foul of the technical regulations.
Okay, so let's move on and get a little more technical. How does the actuator, because I believe that's what it's called, the doodad that makes the wings go flippy, for those of you who are playing along at home, and how does that actually work? And it looks like to me always that the rear wing is split into two sections. What are those called, and which one of those two is actually the one that moves and which one stays still?
Okay, so the bottom of the two elements is what we call the main plane. This is the same if you look at a front wing as well. So when we talk about the main plane, it is the first element in the stack. When you get to the rear wing, we then call the upper element the top flap. So you either call it the upper element or the top flap. The actuator generally, in fact, across the board these days sits in the centre of the wing, and you'll see it housed within a pod. We call it the actuator pod. They are created as an aerodynamic fairing, because obviously you're talking about a metal component that sort of pulls on the wing, the upper flap, the top flap, and pulls it out and up. And so you want to fair that in so obviously it doesn't have an aerodynamic issue and destabilize the wing itself. And then obviously you have furniture outboard of that, where it connects to the end plate. There's pivots there to enable the wing to actually open and close. All of the teams have got their own various ways of doing that. There's not one strict way you must do it in a particular fashion. You know, it's all stuff that's designed in-house specifically for them in order that they get the precise aerodynamic effect that they require when the DRS opens and closes. You might hear about, you know, cars becoming unstable under braking, and sometimes that can be because the DRS doesn't reattach, and what that means is that the airflow over the wing doesn't come back to its stabilized profile in order that you get the downforce. So as I say, there's each team has their own specific designs around the DRS, but they all have a very similar sort of design ethos, if you will.
Okay. And now just a last question. I know that one of our listeners asked, you know, is it possible that the freight delays played a part in this going wrong? But to my knowledge, we don't still know exactly, was it assembled incorrectly? Did something actually break? Because the FIA have not let Mercedes go have a look, and they haven't bothered to take it apart themselves to see what actually went wrong.
Yeah, the problem we have here is something that we don't see too often, is that the FIA actually impounded the component. So in this case, they took the whole rear wing assembly and impounded it so that the team couldn't interfere with it in any way. Mercedes clearly wanted to try to evaluate that so they had some answers as to what had actually happened, whether it was, you know, what kind of manufacturing issue had occurred that had allowed this particular problem to occur in the first place. However, they weren't allowed that, and the FIA kept it for themselves until they'd actually made their decision and you know, come up with a disqualification for Lewis Hamilton. So unfortunately, we're in a situation where the FIA have, you know, kept the wing away from Mercedes, and we haven't really got an answer yet as to what happened. But the FIA have erred on the side of that it was possibly, you know, a problem with one of the mechanisms failing that had caused the wing to be able to be opened that extra 0.2 millimeters.
Okay, so I had wanted to move us to the Mercedes power unit, but it seems like the way things are going, perhaps it makes sense to spend a moment or two on Red Bull, because we have seen them have, as you point out, their fair share of rear wing issues, although they have managed thus far to avoid being penalized for them. But they are continuing to complain about Mercedes' rear wing. And I'm curious if you have any details about what exactly it is they're complaining about, because to my knowledge, they already have added optical dots and are measuring the deflection. That was a problem earlier in Barcelona. So do you know what it is exactly Red Bull are on about? And do you think there is anything really to that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, as you say, we've got to a point this season where flexi wings have really come under the hammer. The FIA have put things in place. They've changed the way in which they're measuring things. They now have the optical dots on the rear wing so that they can monitor from the rearward facing camera and see if those dots are moving, you know, beyond the limits that you would expect them to. There's obviously still some, you know, wiggle room in terms of being able to get some flexibility from the rear wing to be able to get that extra sort of straight line speed boost. I don't think anything that the FIA ever do will stop that from happening, because you can't make these components infinitely rigid, otherwise they just break under aero load. So there has to be some maneuverability in the components themselves in order to that they just don't fail. In terms of what are they actually looking for, well, I think you'd probably have to ask Adrian Newey, because I believe he was at the stewards trying to explain to them exactly what was going on with the Mercedes rear wing itself. I do have some theories around what could possibly be being done, but there was a lot of technical directives entered in this season to try to prevent that sort of thing anyway. So essentially what I believe to be the primary driver of this situation at the moment is that if you can imagine the top flap and main plane, if they were to move together as if they were in a track in the end plate, technically you would be lowering the incidence of these the angles of the wings, but you wouldn't be tilting the wing, which is what, you know, flexi wings kind of were doing up until Baku when, you know, the new regulations came into place. But as I say, there's technical directives in place to try to prevent this sort of thing from happening as well, because in reality, it has happened in the past. So it's a difficult one. I'm not sure where this will sit, but politicking in Formula One has always been prevalent, especially when you have such close battles as we're having right now. You only have to think of McLaren and Ferrari back in 2007, 2008. I think they spent more time with the stewards than they did racing the cars out on track. And it appears that we're in a very similar situation between Red Bull and Mercedes right now. So whatever advantage you can take away from your opposition off the track will always bear fruit on the track. And I think that's kind of where we're at right now.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm just going to close with a quick yes or no question. The last time we saw something like this happen, I believe it was post-Barcelona with the optical dots. And if memory serves, it was, what, about a month before the teams were actually required to comply with the updated standards the FIA instituted, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, the additional deflection tests were introduced, say, a month or so after Barcelona. But the optical dots were something that they added afterwards. It wasn't originally intended to be added into the test regime, but they added them at Baku. That's when those came into place. How much they're actually using them, I do not know, but they are there. They're still, you know, visible on all of the wings out there. So they do have that option to go off and look at the footage.
Okay, so up until the point at which this test was failed and everything changed, the star of the weekend, aside from Lewis Hamilton, had to be the performance of his car and of the new Mercedes power unit. And I know we've sort of briefly had this discussion, but I heard it referred to over the weekend as a new spec engine. And I was just wondering, like, are we talking like a Ferrari new spec engine, as in this is a new homologation? Or are they just talking about the fact that they've gone through and replaced all of the things, which is what they said they'd done, outside of the homologation fence that could be replaced?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it can't be a new specification ICE because you can only make one change this season from the original specification, and Mercedes made that at the very start of the year. So, yeah, what we're looking at is a new internal combustion engine, in as much as that, you know, it's the same design as the previous one. But as you say, there are certain areas within or outside of, in fact, the parameters set out in the regulations that you can make changes. So, you know, things like gaskets and all of that sort of stuff. And there is some chatter around what has been done to the various power units or internal combustion engine, should I say, that Valtteri Bottas has had put into his W12, perhaps as a little bit of a test bed in order to get what they needed to be, you know, a very impressive power unit put together for Lewis Hamilton.
Okay, so one of my favorite things going around right now is the theory that somehow Mercedes is super cooling the air into the plenum, and that is what has given them this massive performance boost. Now, Bubbly Chunks in the patron group would like to know what a plenum is, and is that actually what you think is going on here?
Okay, so we've had this discussion many, many times about Mercedes being the only team in the stable, in the Mercedes stable, to use a liquid to air intercooler. The likes of McLaren, Williams, etc. don't, and Aston Martin obviously don't use the water to, liquid to air coolers. They use an air to air cooler, which you would know as an intercooler. So they have a very different setup to the other teams. Let's put it that way. So they obviously can do certain things that those guys can't do in terms of temperature control. But what we're talking about here is the inlet plenum. So we're talking about where you would end up with the boost going into the internal combustion engine from, you know, this, depending on which cooler, type of cooler that you have. Super cooling sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it? But for me, I don't think there's any particular difference to what Mercedes do to what to some of their competitors do. Let's put it that way. The plenum this year is very different on the Mercedes at power unit compared to what it was last year, because the shape and design has changed. Now, the shape and design changes not because it's something that just looks better. It has things inside it, and predominantly that would be the variable inlet trumpets. So I would surmise that those were altered and changed as part of the upgrade to the internal combustion engine at the start of the season to enable them to move the power curve around somewhat, and to try to get some kind of difference performance from the power unit and the internal combustion engine. So there were lots of changes on at the start of the season in terms of the plenum and whatnot, but we haven't obviously seen anything since because they're locked into spec as soon as they introduced that. And as far as super cooling of the charge air goes, there's not too much you can do because of the sensors that the FIA have on board the cars these days.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Okay, so it's a controlled factor, the temperature of that air that's headed into the combustion chamber.
Well, it's not a controlled factor by the FIA. There's no strict, you know, quantity that has to be followed. There's no strictness in that respect, but I just don't see that there's no viable way under the current regulations of super cooling the air going through that system. I know of ways to do it, but they're more road car based scenarios that I played around with many years ago.
Okay, fair enough. I was just talking about the cooling, not about the total amount of air, because the sensors keep them from having the air. Is that a regulation, or am I just completely off my rocker here?
We- We're talking about the Airbox there, aren't we?
Yeah.
Which is a different side.
Okay.
So you're talking about the ambient air into the turbocharger, which obviously the FIA strictly regulate based on the temperature at track, etc. But we're at the other end of the spectrum there where we've already gone through the turbo. So we were talking about two independent systems almost.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for helping clear that up for me. I appreciate it. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is that this performance in some ways seems kind of remarkable, but they're also playing with a power unit that doesn't have to last as many races as they originally budgeted for. Could that be part of the performance that we are seeing?
I think it's a massive part of the performance that we're seeing, because we have to remember that these power units needed to make 23 races at the start of this season. And although we're down to 22 now, rather than the 23, that means that they still ultimately really needed to make 7 or 8 Grand Prix distances in terms of the internal combustion engine I'm talking now, because obviously some of the components in the power unit only had two components before penalty available to them. So I do think that it's a massive part of where we're seeing the performance from this particular power unit, because effectively that is half the distance it has to maintain in order to get to the end of the season. On top of that, you must also remember that this is a pool of components. So Lewis still has another power unit in totality probably available to him that could be installed for free practice sessions and then swapped for a more powerful unit for qualifying and the race. Now we've not got any more sprints available this season. For me personally, I do feel that there's a massive, massive amount of performance available to them. But obviously that comes with some risk as well, because you're pushing the power unit beyond its operating parameters for which it was originally designed. And this is perhaps where Valtteri played his part in having so many power units effectively chucked on the scrap pile whilst they tried to figure this out, how they could actually make a power unit go so deep.
Well, and that's sort of interesting, because reducing the number of power units was sort of a component of reducing the overall spend of the teams. And I do appreciate, by the way, not taking us on a 45-minute discussion of the appropriateness of the sprint qualifying in the Grand Prix weekend, because I could see there for a moment you were tempted.
There was a bit of rage about to come out, wasn't there? I managed to hold it back though.
Yeah, no, very well done. So the last issue that's come up, and this is really an interesting one, is that Christian Horner has said that Honda only loses about a tenth of a second a lap over its lifetime. But we've heard that the Mercedes is actually degrading at a faster rate. Is that accurate, in your opinion?
I do believe it's accurate. Putting numbers on things like that is always going to be extremely difficult. But I've got a question for you whilst we're on this topic, Matt. Do you know which teams can still make a penalty free on the internal combustion engine?
There's two
teams out there that have only used 3 internal combustion engines so far.
You know, you said that to me, and my immediate thought was, prepare to look really, really stupid. And I think I'm about to fulfill that. I'm going to go with McLaren for one, because to my knowledge, they have absolutely stayed within the limits. The other one, I want to say on internal combustion, I want to say Renault.
Well, you're wrong and wrong, because it's Haas and Alfa Romeo.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there you go. Congratulations. You got me.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, though, isn't it? Two Ferrari-powered teams that can't access the upgraded version of the Ferrari power unit.
Yeah, it is interesting. And that sort of neatly brings us to something that I did want to talk about. Now, I know you are not in the predicting business. And if this season has taught us anything, it's what tracks we think are going to be good for cars are not necessarily so. But that's not going to stop me from trying. So we have 3 tracks left. We have Qatar, we have Jeddah, and we have Abu Dhabi. And in terms of how the tracks look to you, in terms of where you perceive the strengths of the cars to be, I'm just curious if you sense at the moment one team or the other might have an advantage. Like, I'll go first. I'll say the fact they're all nighttime races, I think, helps Mercedes a little bit.
I totally agree with that because of the masking of their tyre issue, predominantly. We've managed to avoid tyres until I don't know how many minutes into this podcast, Matt, but I've now mentioned them, so we've got to go there. But yeah, we know that Mercedes are better in cooler conditions. So as you say, the sort of twilight to night race scenario for them should help them out in some respects, not only from a tyre perspective, but also from a cooling perspective on the power unit as well. So, yeah, I'll go in with you on that one.
Okay, the other thing that really I think I would like to investigate a little bit, and this is where Ferrari comes in, is in looking at the online lap of Jeddah. It struck me that they spent an awful lot of time in eighth gear, which makes me think that energy deployment is going to be, well, very critical at that track. Who does that advantage right now?
I would probably put my money again in the Mercedes pool in that respect, although Honda have made, as we know, massive strides in terms of their power unit going forward. And you have to remember that they've had their first energy store improvement since they entered the sport this season. That's where they've had their one improvement this year, is they've introduced a new energy store. Obviously, that has an impact on how they are able to use their ERS in terms of recovery and deployment. And they certainly seem to have caught up to Mercedes in that respect. Having said that, so have Ferrari. You know, they've made huge strides since they introduced their new ERS system. But the problem for me in terms of ERS is that's heat. You know, that does create a situation where you're having to think about the thermal properties. And as you say, at full chat around Jeddah, I think a lot of the teams are going to be pushed to their limits at that track. It is going to be very, very difficult. And at a stage in the season where most teams can ill afford to have a failure. You know, we've got two teams battling it out at the front, and then we've got two teams battling it out behind them, and neither of those four teams can afford to have any kind of failure going into the last few races, because that just eats points away that obviously means that they lose out to their rivals.
Yeah, they're running out of opportunities to recoup any penalty losses at this point. So so one of the questions that came up from our listeners is, do you think Red Bull might reach a point in these last races where they will have to take another power unit to keep Verstappen, I assume, competitive? Not that no one cares about Perez, but he's not fighting for the Drivers' Championship either.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? I think it all falls down to understanding where they fall within the hierarchy against Mercedes. If I was a gambling man, I would actually potentially think that it might be Mercedes that might think about putting another power unit in Hamilton's pool, just purely because if they're going to run this power unit full tilt to the end, then with their degradation level, you know, that they could end up in a position where it makes it very difficult in the last couple of races to find the performance they need to get the advantage over Max Verstappen and his Red Bull Honda. So, you know, it's become a tactical side game, hasn't it, almost, in that these teams are now thinking, well, let's just chuck another one at it because we'll get a little bit more performance. But as you say, the other side note to that is that the Honda doesn't degrade as much as the Mercedes power unit in terms of the performance that it offers up. So, yeah, it's a toss-up, isn't it? The last thing I personally want to see is a failure that turns this championship over to one side. I want to see them go right to the end with it. But, you know, it could come down to that, unfortunately.
Yeah, it could. So speaking of new power units, do you have a quantification of what a new power unit might be worth to a team? in terms of just like just basic horsepower?
Again, it's difficult to quantify, isn't it? But it looks like Mercedes, you know, they tend to get a big shove in terms of performance, whereas some of the other teams don't tend to have that kind of big performance advantage at the beginning because they've set their stall out so that the degradation level is much smaller as they go through the races with it. But, you know, you've got to look somewhere in the region of 25 horsepower upwards, haven't you? I mean, looking at the power performance that Hamilton had in Brazil, I mean, the Red Bull is no slouch around that track either. We have to remember, you know, that they work well at altitude. And although it's not the same altitude challenge that you have in Mexico, Brazil is the second on the calendar. I think it's 726 meters from memory. You know, so I think Hamilton could have had somewhere in the region of maybe 30 to 40 horsepower advantage. That was just, I mean, he was sailing past people like they were stood still on the straight. So, you know, it was a big advantage.
Yeah, well, actually, it brings up an interesting point because I'm wondering, do you think maybe it's more than just the power unit, especially at Brazil, where they've not traditionally had that level of advantage? Do you think maybe they found something setup-wise that also worked particularly well with that kind of a track?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've got the generalized talk about the stalling of diffusers and all of that sort of trickery that people seem to be very interested in at the moment that haven't really paid much attention to it, even though it's been there for a decade and seven teams on the grid have it. But yeah, that, you know, every little small detail counts. One thing that I have noticed is that there was a bit of a conversation going on that Mercedes were running Monaco level downforce in Brazil. And they were not running Monaco level downforce in Brazil. There's an easy way to tell when Mercedes are running high downforce or their highest downforce setting, and that is a double T-wing on the rear of the car and a almost barn door rear wing. And they didn't have those on the car in Brazil. They had their single, what I like to call Superman T-wing, because it's got sort of the Superman logo in the central section. And it was a fairly high downforce rear wing, but it certainly wasn't their highest. And in comparison to Red Bull, who obviously always run that little bit skinnier, you know, it might look like they were running a lot of downforce, but they certainly weren't running Monaco levels.
Yeah, I was just about to say the exact same thing about the T-wings. Just, yeah, how could you miss that?
It's all the small details, Max. All the small details.
It really is. So before we move on to what I want to ask you about sort of the challenges to teams, because we have two brand new tracks, as far as I know. I think there might be someone on the grid who's raced at Qatar, because I believe it was a GP2 race some time ago. But certainly the teams have never been there. Do you know the tire choices going into the last three races in terms of is it 1-2-3, 2-3-4, 3-4-5 from Pirelli? And am I wrong in thinking that the harder the tire is, the more Mercedes develops an advantage from that?
I don't know off the top of my head is the answer to your question. I probably have the emails from Pirelli. So you've caught me out for once.
Okay, I've returned the favor, you mean.
Yes, because I haven't got it to hand, but I probably do have that information. In terms of tyre selection, yes, I would agree that Mercedes generally go better when the harder compounds are selected out of the groups. And that is just purely because of the way that they work the tyre over a stint. They were very quick on the medium, though, in Brazil. And I'm not sure which compound it was off the top of my head. I think it was C3. So it'd be interesting, as you say, to see what is available to them at the next three races. And that, to me, is part of the black art of these next two races, is understanding the tyres. Whoever understands the tyres the best out of these next two races is probably going to have a massive advantage over their rivals. So, you know, profiling the circuit, the asphalt, and understanding just how much scrub is taken out of the tyre is going to be massive in terms of performance.
Okay, so let's talk about that real quick. What are the specific challenges, aside from the tire profiling, which you just mentioned? What are the teams looking at? What is going to make having a brand new track more difficult for them than going to a track that they've been to before. And this is going to be obviously all the teams, not just Mercedes and Red Bull.
Well, I think a lot of that will come down to the ability to think quickly on your feet as well in terms of strategy, because when you don't have an historic profile for a circuit, you have no data to work with. So you don't understand, you know, perhaps when to when the stints are running out of life and you need to get off those tyres. You need to get onto something a little bit different to be able to extract the lap time. You know, you can do so much of that in terms of simulation tools, but it's not quite the same as being at a race weekend. And because we've not been to those circuits before, nobody has that data. So they'll obviously be having to make those decisions on the hoof, which makes life that just a little bit more difficult.
Okay, great. The last question I have for you, and this is a very specific question, is, and I know Abu Dhabi has done some reprofiling, but do we know, have there been any specific changes prior to the Formula One returning to the track?
But in terms of your thinking about the track, obviously there are changes to the track this coming race, which I do think is going to have a bearing on performance, because certain, let's say, difficult corners that were not drivers' corners have been changed or reprofiled. And I think that will have a bearing on the tyre performance, not only from drivers having to learn how to operate and get in and out of those corners more effectively, but obviously how much life it takes out of the tyres. I don't think people really kind of understand the job that drivers do to tyre save. It is quite an interesting thing to watch for. You know, people always talk about karting lines and those sort of things, but you know, you can see that drivers drive a very different line from time to time to be able to save on the tires, fuel save, you know, do these sort of management things that go on in the background that are just taken for granted.
Okay, so before we head on off into the sunset here, we did have some questions about not just the immediate future, but the slightly more future. And one of the ones that came up most is, do you have any idea or any notion which particular areas of the car the teams are really focused on that might be really different to what we've seen thus far produced from the FIA?
I assume we're talking about 22 car here.
Yep.
Yeah, the floor, essentially. Floor, diffuser, that region is going to be a huge amount of performance in it. You know, some of the trinket bits that come on the front edge of the floor, like the dividing strakes. And then we're sort of into things that will be highly specific to teams. So things like side pod design, engine covers, cooling solutions, which I think could be a very interesting topic next year, because we've got the louvers back in the, you know, sort of tail area of the side pod, which means that the Coke bottle region could effectively be so narrow. But that obviously will depend highly on, you know, how good the power units are and all of that sort of stuff. So, but I think that predominantly the biggest areas that the teams will be focused on is the areas where they can find the biggest amount of performance straight out the blocks. And the biggest area of performance that they'll be able to find at the beginning will be from the floor.
Okay. Along with that, we're moving to a different fuel next season, 10% and E10 fuel. And PJ, one of our patrons, would like to know, how much of an impact do you think we will see from that shift?
I don't think that, you know, as a perception point of view, I don't think people will actually realize that there's any kind of difference going on. That's all happened back at the manufacturers, with those guys finding the ways in which that they can still find the same level of performance from the power unit, but obviously with 10% ethanol based fuel. So I think we'll continue to see that as the years go by. You know, we're looking at 2026 having a slightly different framing to the power unit regulations. And again, I believe that there will be more push towards a more highly sustainable fuel. So, you know, there's always work going on in the background. And They're always finding performance, but it's all relative. It's not something that you can realistically, tangibly put your finger on or see out there on the track.
Okay, great. And of course, since you know I love tires, I'm going to end up with a question from John M. Everyone talks about needing to get tires into the window, talking about, obviously, the temperatures, tread, and bulk. But how big is the window? A couple of degrees? 5, 10, 20, 50? How small is this particular eye of the needle these engineers are trying to thread?
Well, again, it's something that can't realistically be answered thoroughly because it depends on the car. You know, and the set of circumstances that you're at, the circuit, the track temperatures, there's a huge amount of variables involved in getting the tire into the working range, as we call it. Pirelli do offer a working range selection for each of their tires. So they will tell you the degrees that they will operate effectively in. If you're outside of those, then you know, the tyres are pretty much shut off and not doing anything. But then it's a bit of a Goldilocks effect. You know, still within that window, there are areas within it that make it perform that much little better or worse, depending on where they are in a stint. You know, because this is the other thing that you have to consider is that during a stint, the window will change because you're taking away tread from the tire, which means that more heat can escape from the tire and the tread platform, which means that window is suddenly shifting around as well. So it's always a moving target is the simple answer. There are, you know, the windows that Pirelli offer as a guidance to what those tires should, you know, work semi decently in, but then there are very, very small areas or pockets of performance that can be found within as well.
Yeah, that was always my understanding, that there was always a sweet spot within you've hit it correctly that the tires could be in. And I think one of my favorite things that I read recently was an engineer talking about tires saying, we could run the exact same test on a tire 5 times in a row and get 5 different results because they're just that complicated.
There's a reason it's called a black art.
Indeed. So Summers, where can we find you on social media? Where should people go look for your pearls of wisdom?
Well, on social media, the best place always is Twitter, and it's SummersF1. And you can find my stuff mainly on motorsport.com.
Excellent. As for me, I'm at MattPT55 on the Twitters. And until next time, drive hard, play loose, and be kind to your tires. This has been Missed Apex Podcast. Well, seems like I've managed to record it all, at least.
Well, that's a bonus.
Yeah, it's the lowest bar I could set for myself.
Well, I think it went okay.
I think so. I think we got some good information. So thanks for coming along.